comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you happen to be, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here. I know you could be doing a million other things, but you chose to be here, and I do appreciate that. It means a lot to me that you're here. I'm here because you have a right to know, and because you matter. There has been here in the United States an extremely important event that has taken place. An outlandishly egregious violation of a citizen's constitutional and civil rights by the government. And lots of people have been following that. It has to do with a former Marine who was posting some things on Facebook that, according to the government, were anti-government, which, by the way, in the United States of America is abso-freaking-lutely legal. That's a new word for you, maybe, abso-freaking-lutely. Legal. It's constitutional to say whatever you want to say about the government. But anyway, they say he was posting some things on there that were anti-government, and they thought he was a threat to himself and to others. Of course, if you are posting things that are anti the policies of this government, you're only a threat to the people who are promoting those policies. You're a threat to their power, that's all. So let's get this where it is. This was a threat to the naked greed for power in this government. And so the FBI, the SS, that's the Secret Service, the police, they all went out, grabbed him at his house, arrested him, took him in, had him committed to a mental institution. So the country has been pretty much really in an uproar about this, at least people who like the Constitution have been. And yesterday, a judge in Virginia, that's where this happened, ruled that indeed this man's rights had been violated, and he ordered his release. He ordered him to be released from custody. I just before showtime was notified that he has in fact been released now, and I think it's important for us to say at least thank God for at least one judge with sanity. I hope there are more, but this one judge helped to preserve the Constitution in ways far bigger than the Supreme Court, who have, as of late, turned their backs on the Constitution. It's also of note that the Oath Keepers showed up at this mental hospital. Oath Keepers are law enforcement officers and military personnel who have sworn to uphold their oath to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Who ever thought we would have to defend the Constitution from the government? We'll be back. right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. And as I was saying when we went away for break, whoever thought that we would have to have people like Oath Keepers to defend the Constitution from the onslaughts by our own hired hands in the government. Well, I'm glad for them. I'm glad for the judge who is sane, and I'm glad that Brandon Raub has been released. Now, let me say this, and then we'll bring our guest on. Why is this important, and why does it have a place here on this show? Because we don't talk about this kind of thing normally. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Brandon Raub, I don't know anything about him other than what I have read and heard since he got arrested. What I've read and what I've heard, I would say that my views and his views do not coincide. We're not on the same side of the fence with in terms of what we think the solutions are. But you see, I don't have to agree with your views for me to agree with your right to express those views. I don't have to agree with Brandon Raub's views in order for me to agree with his rights guaranteed under the Constitution. You know, the Constitution doesn't give me any rights. It guarantees to back the government off and tell them to back the hell off and leave that alone. And freedom of speech is the first one. So his right to say what he says, whether I agree with him or not, that's exactly equal to my right to say what I say. And it's exactly equal to your right. So if they get away with dumping his rights down the tube, they just got away with dumping yours and mine. So that's why it's important. This show and every talk show depends upon our right to freedom of speech. So I'm very, very glad that things have turned out as they have. Now the next step needs to be warrants issued against the FBI and the SS, the Secret Service, and against the police who were involved in this illegal capture and commitment of Brandon Raub. These guys, Billy Badass with a badge, need to be put in jail. Yeah, I know, that puts me on a list. Please, put me on another one. My guest this evening is Christopher O'Brien. Christopher O'Brien is probably the leading paranormal investigator in all of the American Southwest. And he's got a very long track record of investigating not just paranormal, but all kinds of, you know, strange phenomena in the American Southwest. The American Southwest, of course, is that great area out there, you know, New Mexico, Colorado, part of Colorado, Arizona. I guess you could even include part of Utah in that. You know, it's that we usually think of it as desert, but it isn't all desert. But that whole area, that is the area that he has been active in investigating most. From 1992 until 2002, he investigated 1,000 reports of strange phenomena in this area, and as a journalist reported on them, as an author wrote books about them, and since then has been continually active in investigating and writing about the very strange things that happen in that part of our country. And let me tell you, there are many, many strange things in that part of the country. Christopher O'Brien is on the telephone with me at the moment, simply because we were having problems with Skype, and we will switch over to Skype But we're going to start off on the telephone. Christopher, welcome to the show. It's good to have you back with us.
Yeah, it's good to be back on, Kevin. Thanks.
Christopher, recently, now the last, I think the last time you were here, we talked about some mysteries in the Southwest and also in South America. But I want to talk about this most recent expedition that you took. It intrigues me, and it intrigues me because what you went to look for. Now, folks, I'll go ahead and tell you what it is, and then we'll let him tell the story all about this. He went to look for a reported lost Egyptian city in the Grand Canyon. Now, the Grand Canyon is the big ditch in Arizona. You know where? That's what it is, a big ditch.
Yeah.
In Arizona.
Big wound in the earth.
Big wound in the earth. That is absolutely true. We know where it is. We know what you went to look for. But now tell us the story about this lost Egyptian city. Egyptian city in the Grand Canyon?
Yeah, you're on that one, huh? You know, I've been a real fan of legends and mysteries pertaining to what has been reported, I think, over the years as an antediluvian tunnel system that is many thousands of years old, that I've stumbled on mentions of this particular tunnel system in my investigative work over the years. I happened to find a underground miner, a little Spanish guy who claimed he was helping expand the Los Alamos National Lab back in the early to mid-50s, and his team broke into what appeared to be an ancient tunnel system that was east of the San Luis, or the Los Alamos National Lab, and they could tell by the amount of mineralization within this particular tunnel system that it was many thousands of years old. Of course, it was totally covered up by the supervisors of the miners who were doing the demolitions and excavations underground. His five-person team was broken up into various, each member was put onto a different team, and they were sworn to silence. And it's little hints and stories like this that I've encountered over the years that have always led me to believe that there is a good likelihood that there is an extensive tunnel system that crisscrosses portions of the Southwest. Having met and become friends of sorts with Richard Souter, Dr. Souter, of course, to many of your listeners, they're aware that he is the author of Underground Bases and Tunnels, What is the Government Trying to Hide? And he's probably, he would get my bet as the top expert in this particular subject area. But one thing in my research that I encountered was a story that was published in the Phoenix Gazette, which was the newspaper of the time in Arizona, in 1909. And the story purported a discovery of an underground city in the Marble Canyon portion of Grand Canyon, which is just east of the National Park. And supposedly this guy was prospecting. He was coming down the Colorado River. He got to a spot about 3 miles above the confluence of the Little Colorado River, where it comes in and meets the Colorado River on the east side of Grand Canyon of the National Park area. And about 1,300 feet up from the river, he spied what appeared to be like stain coming down the cliff face, and he noticed that there looked like a doorway. So with some difficulty, he rock climbed basically up to the location, went inside, and was astounded to find an incredible underground city, which he then reported to the Smithsonian. He was loosely associated with the Smithsonian, and this guy's name was G.E. Kincaid. And the Smithsonian, there are several versions of this story, but But one thing that we do know for sure is that the Phoenix Gazette newspaper published quite an extensive article that described his journey and gave some very, very specific descriptions of what he discovered underground, which appeared to be a large central chamber that had spokes, passageways running from the central chamber off, radiating out like spokes from a wheel. And along these corridors were dozens and dozens of small rooms that almost appeared like dormitory rooms. And he found what he claimed was evidence of some sort of Asiatic civilization. Based on the descriptions, it almost reminds us today of Tibetan-type artifacts, but also Egyptian-type artifacts, including a golden Buddha that was seated, and quite a number of, I think the number, if I remember correctly, was 33 different mummy artifacts of mummified humans that were in these niches of this central chamber. And the story did run in 1909, the end of the first week or beginning of the second week of April. Some skeptics have pointed out that the timing may suggest that it could have been an April Fool's joke, but we have enough evidence from people over the years that have investigated this and really dug into, pardon the expression, dug into this story, and it does appear that there is some sort of underground facility right at the confluence where the Little Colorado River comes from the north down and joins the Colorado River, of course, which is Grand Canyon at that point. And there's, you know, a body of evidence, anecdotal, that there is some sort of extensive, you know, infrastructure underground there. And what makes the story even more compelling to me is if you go around the corner from where he claims he found the entrance, if you go downriver to the confluence and then up the Colorado River Gorge about two and a half miles, you have what the Hopi consider to be their most sacred site, which is the 70-foot travertine dome on the banks of the Little Colorado River, which looks like a giant anthill, if you will. And they claim that that is where the Hopi are led underground by Creator just before the Earth cleanses itself between the worlds. We're right now currently at the end of the fourth world. And that they're cared for underground for an indeterminate amount of time by what are described by the Hopi as ant people. So this, I think it's not by accident that you have, you know, this ancient legend of an underground facility. And then just around the corner within is the Crow Flies, about 5 miles. You have the claims of this of G.E. Kincaid and then later S.A. Jordan, who was sent by the Smithsonian to investigate this site back in 1909. You have these two seemingly, you know, I would think, descriptions of some sort of underground facility. So based on this and... we can go into some more details, obviously, on how the expedition was put together, but based on these basic facts, this is what prompted the expedition.
Well, I do want to add this information, and that is in that newspaper article, which, by the way, those who are watching, if you're not watching, go over to my website, scroll down, you'll see the picture about tonight's show. That's the picture that I'm showing on our TV channel now. And on the left side of that picture is a picture of that page of the newspaper when it ran in 1909. Mm-hmm. And this is the article. And this article talks about the Smithsonian taking over. It gives the name of the guy who took over the excavation of this, the operation. It gives details about, you know, a great many people being hired to work and electrical wiring being strung inside of this cavern so they would have lights. And it talks about, if I'm not mistaken, a rail spur that was built out to very near this site. And the reason that I bring that up is because there are just way too many details for this to be an April Fool's joke. Plus, from satellite photographs, the location of that rail spur has been found. Yeah, when they were through, they took up the rails.
That was ground zero for, that was our destination when we mounted the expedition, was that particular point where, as I said, the Little Colorado has its confluence with the Colorado River. And we're talking, you know, a 4,000-foot sheer cliff that needed to be negotiated by the recovery team. And there are some pretty interesting divergent versions of what exactly happened once this particular find was reported to the Smithsonian. We don't really know what was found, if they were able to even recover anything from there, although there have been claims over the years that the Smithsonian did actually recover. In one version I found there was a claim that 109 truckloads of artifacts were actually pulled out of this particular cavern system, and you know, I've heard varying time periods from 2.5 to 3.5 months were spent by the investigators and the recovery team to pull all those artifacts out. And of course, the Smithsonian denies all of this.
Well, they even deny that Johnson worked for them, don't they?
Pardon me?
They even denied at one point, and maybe still do, that Johnson worked for them.
Yeah, he was associated with them. He wasn't a paid employee. He was like a stringer for them. He was a contract worker for them. That much has been established by investigators. There is an evidence train that does corroborate that claim by him. He wasn't actually working directly for the Smithsonian, though. He was like a bird dog for them, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a break coming up, and during this break, we'll try to hook up on Skype.
Yeah, I'm showing up loud and clear for you. So.
Yeah, you will just hear silence until the break, start to come out of the break.
Okay.
All right, folks, we are going to step away for a break. And when we come back, we're going to get some more details about this expedition to find this lost Egyptian or Asian city in the Grand Canyon. We shall return right after this.
To the Kevin Smith Show. When it comes to the world of the strange and unexplained, Kevin ropes in the information like a radio cowboy and rustles it to the ground with no mercy. He's our voice because we matter. Become a member today.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. If I can find my voice, I'm here. The guest is here. My voice went on vacation. Now, the deal is, you know, we're trying to do the rest of our interview using the marvelous and wonderful technology of Skype because we get better audio out of it. It frees up more phone space and so forth. But there's a lot of thunder and lightning happening where our guest is. As a result, we've been having real problems getting Skype to stay online. But we're going to give it a try. And let me just see. On Skype, we just lost him. Okay, tell you what we're going to do. We're going to forget Skype and just stick with the telephone. Well, I don't know. Let's give it another try here. Are you with me, Chris? Well, yeah. See, we just got technical issues there. We'll stick with the telephone and continue our interview. Okay, Chris, are you with me on the telephone?
I am.
Okay, yeah, we'll just stick with the telephone. It's crazy
here right now, boy. I've got a major thunderstorm going on.
Yeah, well, that may be the issue. Okay, when was this expedition to find the lost Egyptian city?
The original one or the one that I just put together here?
Yeah, the one you just finished.
This was in the latter part of May of this year.
Okay. And your goal, as I appreciate it, was that you wanted to find the location. Did you expect that you would also find any artifacts?
Well, basically no. Because of the actual location of the entrance, it's virtually impossible to get to that particular part of the canyon wall from the rim, which is above the river, about 4,000 feet above the river. What we were planning on doing is doing a survey of that particular stretch of Marble Canyon with the aid of a remote-controlled helicopter armed with a video camera. And what we were going to do is map the cliff face along that stretch of Marble Canyon to then zero in on any sort of entrance, and then mount an additional expedition to come up from the river. The only way you can really get to that location without rappelling down, almost 2,000 feet, the only way to get there is coming up from the river.
Okay, so the main thing was to locate it and map it.
Correct. Yeah.
Were you successful in locating it?
Well, you know, we've narrowed it down to what we think is about a 3/4 mile stretch. No, we weren't able to actually get an eyes on view of it. Unfortunately, the helicopter idea was sound in theory, but we had just a ferocious 50-mile-an-hour wind, and there was no way we were going to be able to fly any sort of 4-foot helicopter to to locate it. I just couldn't justify putting the gear at risk with the kinds of winds that we were experiencing the whole time we were there. So unfortunately, we weren't able to actually, attain the goal that we had set out to accomplish. But with subsequent research and working with other investigators who have been spending decades, actually in one case, attempting to locate this particular entrance that was reported by Jordan, we've narrowed it down to about a 3/4 mile stretch there. Our next expedition will be coming from the river, and there'll be a second team that'll be up on the rim where we were in May, and we'll be working in conjunction with one another. And I'm working on a system of a very stable kite, because the wind kind of rendered the idea of a unfettered helicopter with no control lines, basically trying to remotely pilot the thing. Why not use the wind to our advantage? Because the wind is very predictable there. We're going to fly a fairly stable three-string kite out with a self-leveling device, a mounting device with a camera on it, and actually use the kite and camera to then map for our next trip.
You know, it would seem that a lot of people have gone out looking for this since that report came out in 1909. It would seem if the original guy could see it from the river and could climb up to it and then climb back down, and then if the Smithsonian could go in there and take 109 truckloads of artifacts out, that it should be easily identifiable and not impossible to access now, unless something's changed.
Well, see, and you would think that. But according to Jordan's account, he just lucked out when he actually was able to spot evidence of what he thought initially were mine tailings. He was actually looking for paleo mining sites. And you can't actually see the entrance from the river. You have to be up almost 1,000 feet from the river. And the entrance is set in such a way that you can't get a direct visual, you know, the line of sight and view of it unless you're up quite a ways up the cliff face, hiking along the cliff face about, I think it was 700 or 800 feet up from the river. So it is kind of hidden. So unless you know exactly where to look, and there are many, you know, cave-type features in that part of the canyon, unless you know exactly where to look, that's huge territory there. I mean, we're talking, it's just, it is beyond rugged. And I'm not surprised that, you know, that the investigators that I've talked to and researchers who have looked into this whole story, including Jack Andrews, who has spent his first trip there looking for it was in the 70s, I think he's the one that's gotten closest to it and has the best information about the exact location of where this thing is. It isn't as easy as one would think to spot it.
All right, well, let's talk about the nature of the artifacts as they were described. Basically, they are Asian, maybe some Egyptian. But if there's a Buddha in there, it's certainly Asian. So what this would imply, in fact, what it would demand, is the conclusion that many thousands of years ago, some Asian people, don't know from where, arrived at what is today the Grand Canyon. And for whatever reason, built this, I don't know really from the descriptions whether it's a city or whether it is a mausoleum.
Yeah, that's a good point, Kevin. Based on the descriptions and the actual layout of the rooms and the way the corridors are aligned, it's almost like a back in the 50s, it's a duck and cover, almost like bunker. But large enough to house tens of thousands of people.
Oh.
So, you know, yeah, I guess it would depend on how you want to take the description and then put your own interpretation of what that particular complex was used for. But there are many, many hundreds of rooms. Corridors go up close to 1,000 feet. Based on his descriptions, and the amount of artifacts that were there would indicate that it did at one point house many thousands of people. Again, this is all based on the initial descriptions. But, you know, they found metal tools. They found artifacts that could not be, if this turns out to be real and accurate, these artifacts would not conform with the level of technology that Native Americans had, you know, even 300 or 400 years ago, prior to the Spanish arrival, you know, 400 or 500 years ago. So it would indicate that some outside, more technologically advanced, group of people were somehow involved in this. Now, obviously, you know, conventional archaeology and conventional anthropology would, you know, look at a story like this and say it's poppycock, there's nothing to it. We all know that ancient civilizations did not arrive in the New World until possibly the Vikings. We do have some information that came out within the last year that some ancient paleo man from the south of France may have inadvertently made their way during the winter months over the ice pack to the New World. We have discovered now these very elaborate caches of very exquisite points, hunting points, for hunting large game animals that have been found in Virginia. And there is evidence that man was here at some point prior to the accepted date of about 12,500 years ago, when supposedly the first humans arrived in the New World over the Bering Straits and then migrated the way down the west coast and populated north and then possibly even Central and South America. That's conventional theory, but diffusionist archaeologists refute that and say, well, you know, ancient civilizations used the oceans like we do today as highways, and they were quite aware of each other. They did not spring up in isolation. They were aware of other cultures around the world and had active trading routes and that sort of thing. And so, you know, if you look at the work of David Hatcher Childress, who was one of the people on the expedition, I might add, you can look at the conventional academic and scientific theories about the introduction of humans into North America with a different light, and obviously,
well, the
existence of this cavern would rewrite the history books.
The traditional accepted establishment theory of how this area that we call the United States today, how it became populated, that establishment view is provably poppycock, because, you know, if they came in across the Bering Strait when it was iced over and they filtered their way down, your first towns, your oldest settlements, would be further north, and they would be younger as you move further south. But the oldest settlements in the Americas are in South America. They're not in North America. So they were populated long before anybody trickled across the Bering Strait. And then in Florida, they now have a large population, a large archaeological site with a large population of Caucasians from about 15 to 20,000 years ago. All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Christopher O'Brien. We're talking about his expedition into the Grand Canyon area, into the Grand Canyon, looking for this reported lost Egyptian city. That's what people call it, but the descriptions really sound more Asian than Egyptian. As we went away for break, I was explaining why I think the establishment theory of the population of the Americas, how it all happened, is poppycock, rather provably, because the oldest settlements and cities are in South America, not in the upper reaches of North America, where you would expect them, if that is the source of the population, and that they filtered their way down into South America. But the oldest settlements and cities, grand cities, are in South America. So it just didn't happen the way they tell us. I watched a documentary, Chris, about a year ago. You've probably seen it, about the Chinese actually having discovered America before the so-called discovery of America by Christopher Columbus, who actually had maps that had America on it when he discovered it. So what do you think? How and when did these ancients get here?
Well, that's really the big question. We have a ton of evidence. If you take the work of Michael Cremo, who wrote the, I think, the textbook on this subject called Forbidden Archaeology.
Right.
Also, Barry Fell wrote a book called America BC. There's quite a number of books out there that are extremely well-researched and give us all kinds of tantalizing hints and clues based on finds in the Americas over the years of artifacts that couldn't possibly conform to the conventional theory of isolation from humans up until the point of you know, 12,000 to 13,000 years ago, when conventional theory states that humans were introduced into the New World. And, you know, I mean, the Olmec civilization is kind of became founded and grew up and spawned right at this at the narrowest point in southern Mexico, for instance. And if you look at the large stone heads at La Venta and around Tabasco and those areas, these huge basalt, you know, 10, 12-foot high stone heads, some of them look like they have Chinese features. They feature, you know, there are figurines that have been found of what look like Chinese in lotus positions doing mudras with their hands. They have all the earmarks of being Asiatic, facial hair. And some of the large stone heads that I was previously mentioned here look African, large, flat, broad noses, helmets that look similar to the types of headgear that were worn by the great ancient civilizations in Africa. So, I mean, just looking at it from what we already have discovered in terms of evidence that would indicate that there has been... humans have visited North America for thousands of years, possibly, and I mean, they found a Roman gladius, you know, a Roman sword down in Tucson. They found all kinds of artifacts that are featured in Forbidden Archaeology and America BC and other books. So it seems to me that you know, the work of people like Barry Fell and Michael Cremo, David Hatcher Childress, you know, have really put, I think, that conventional history and that conventional academic theory into question.
I think they've put it in the dustbin. But you know, that's just my opinion.
That
but
alone is enough to make you know, genealogists kind of wet, you know, lick their lips and go, let me at some DNA testing. Why did they find a very tall, you know, Caucasian skeleton that's 12,000 years old in Washington State. The red-haired giants that were found in the Lovelock Caves of Nevada, for instance, 8 and 9 foot tall giants. The Hopi Indians, who were, you know, I've done quite a bit of research into southwestern Pueblo Indian traditions. The Hopi and Zuni being probably the primordial cultures in North America, and looking at some of their myths and legends that have passed down very, very carefully for hundreds and hundreds of generations, you know, they have a tradition that I think has not been given its due by conventional academia, and they talk about being here for tens of thousands of years, and actually going underground at this location where we mounted the expedition towards, and being protected underground during earth changes. And, you know, of course, according to their tradition, we're probably at the end of the fourth world here. And one of the motivations that I had to put the expedition together, along with some team members who we can talk about here in a minute, one of my motivations was to see if there was indeed a connection between this legendary entrance into, you know, at the Cipapulima, as the Zuni call it, or Cipapu, as the anglicized version of it, this travertine dome that's on the banks, the eastern banks of the Little Colorado, which is like the back door to this city. I've always felt, since I found out about the Jordan claim from 1909, that there was obviously some sort of connection, because these two sites are too close together for there not to be a connection. So that was one of my main motivating your motivations to attempt this expedition to see if this underground city was somehow tied into the Hopi and Zuni legends?
Okay, let's talk about the team members. Who was on this expedition?
Well, it's really interesting, yeah, the way the whole thing kind of unfolded. Back in 2011, Gary David, who's a fellow musician and good friend, Gary wrote the book The Orion Zone. He's an archaeoastronomer, and he was the first one to figure out and notice that all the sacred sites and village sites and ancient Pueblo ruin sites, if you look at them from above, let's say, from space, and you plot them out on a map, they overlay perfectly with the array of stars and constellations in the night sky. In other words, these sacred sites and village locations mirror the sky. And he wrote a very compelling book called The Orion Zone, which I highly recommend for anyone that's interested in these subjects. He was doing a Google Earth search of the confluence area back in 2011 and discovered some very unusual features, which he sent the coordinates along to David Hatchett Childress and myself. David's my next-door neighbor. We're very close. We mount expeditions several times a year. And Gary said, hey, we should maybe put together a trip to go here and investigate these unusual road configurations and other things that he discovered on Google Earth. We should investigate them. So I took it upon myself this spring to line Gary up and David and David's wife, Jennifer Boehm. We also brought along a petroglyph expert, Ron Regere. I think you've had Ron on the show, actually.
Yeah, I have. A couple of times, as a matter of fact.
Pardon me?
Yeah, he's been on the show a couple of times.
Yeah. Ron, of course, is a retired aerospace engineer. He was in charge of engineering manuals for most of the optics programs for our space program from Apollo up until the end of the 20th century. He's also working on a dictionary of petroglyphs to kind of equate, the glyphs with a particular meaning. He's been researching this for many years. Also, J.C. Johnson, who is a river guide and cryptozoologist based in Farmington, amazing guy. He's he's probably the coolest guy I've ever sat around a campfire with. I'll tell you, the guy has more stories than I got hair on my head. He's pretty amazing. We also, Ron's wife, Darlene, came along. She's a ranger at Mesa Verde National Monument. JC also brought along his friend Audrey, who's a security officer at Apache County. Also, Clifford Mahudi, who was on the show here, I think, last time I was on, if I remember correctly. He's a Zuni elder who was in charge of civil engineering projects on Native American reservations for the Bureau of Indian Affairs for 25 years. And he's an expert at assessing sacred site usage and is, a top-notch civil engineer. So I kind of chose the team members very carefully to be as well-rounded with our expertise as possible. And
all right, we have to step away for a break, and we'll pick up there when we come back. More with Chris O'Brien after this. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Christopher O'Brien. For those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're glad to have you. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from us for the first hour. We are talking about an expedition led by Chris O'Brien, an expedition into a particular part of the Grand Canyon for the purpose of attempting to locate something that was reported in a newspaper article in 1909. And what was reported was an ancient city inside a cavern. Some of the description sounds somewhat Egyptian. Some of it sounds somewhat Asian. And we're talking with Christopher O'Brien about that. As we went away for break, we were talking about the team. But Christopher, I want to make an observation right now before I forget it, because I'm an old guy and I forget stuff. I just happened to think about it just now. You actually brought up something that is possibly a sort of a key to understanding this location a little bit. The description in the newspaper had some things that sounded Egyptian and some things that sounded Asian. You mentioned just a few minutes ago the Olmec in right at the southern narrow tip of Mexico, the ancient Olmec, some of their carvings look decidedly Asian, and then some of their carvings, those great stone heads, look decidedly African. Mm-hmm. So you have two ethnic groups in one culture there. It is possible, isn't it, that in this lost city you had two ethnic groups in one civilization, one culture there?
Well, that is the implication here. Obviously, until we actually get a chance to go in there, and if the government hasn't already cleaned the cavern out, which if I had to bet money, I'd pretty much assume that the cavern has been cleaned out. But if it hadn't been, obviously the final evidence of that would be found there. And we can at some point here go in and talk about the government's capability of mapping under the underground from space. And there's a good possibility that somebody has already started developing that particular underground location based on what we discovered and were able to videotape, but we can talk about that further along in the show.
Yeah, we will in just a moment. I want to go back to the team because I listed everybody you mentioned, and so it looks like your team, including you, was a team of 9 people.
Correct.
Okay. So when you got to this location, when we talk about the Grand Canyon, there is the Grand Canyon as you stand at the top and look down, and there's the Grand Canyon as you stand at the bottom and look up. You guys were on the top or down at the bottom?
We were on the rim. We were at the top. In order to get to that location, on the Colorado River, you have to, kind of mount your expedition 2 years in advance. And that is a very popular boat trip for whitewater rafting, and there's a waiting list about 2 years. What we're going to do is get a variance for or hire the permit holder to allow us to tack on our own expedition on one of the permit holder's permits. And this coming year, we're going to mount an expedition that has two teams, one on the river coming down from Lee's Ferry, and then another team that'll be where we were on top of the rim, 4,000 feet above the river, on the eastern side of the confluence. And we'll be working in conjunction with one another, and a kite system that will then map the section of the Marble Canyon cliff face there on the southern side of the river that will that we are pretty sure the entrance that Jordan found is there. Another expedition could be mounted going down the Salt Trail Canyon, which is the sacred migration route out of the Little Colorado River Gorge, where the Native Americans, when they emerged into this current Fourth World, they they went about 2 miles upstream of the Little Colorado, made a left turn, and headed east up the Salt Trail Canyon. So that would even be a third expedition at some point if we can get permission to go down in that area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let me ask you this. With all these expeditions planned, do you have, you personally, do you have real expectations that you will find the entrance to this lost city?
Well, I mean, yeah, in a perfect world, it would be great. I'm actually a guide. I lead private tours up to Grand Canyon as one of my main kind of cash flow jobs. I'm the lead driver for the top private tour company out of Sedona. I have been up to Grand Canyon over 200 times, and every time I stand at the furthest eastern point of the national park and I look over that 14-mile stretch to the confluence, every time I've stood there, I've wondered about that underground city. And so when Gary found these strange rectangular road system at the confluence, that was all I needed to go ahead and mount the expedition. I'm not one of those guys that assumes that everything that I plan to do is going to be, you know, bear fruit. In my wildest dreams, it would be great to find evidence of this particular entrance. It is extremely rugged territory there. It's going to take quite a bit of effort, and putting ourselves in danger, actually climbing up to that level, if we do actually manage to locate the entrance. It is really dangerous. country there, and take it from somebody who knows, having been up in that area so many times. I don't look at this project lightly. I would like to bring in some professional rock climbers. I do have rock climbing training, but back when I was a teenager, I'm not as physically fit as it would take to do some of the arduous climbing. However, if a route was established up to an entrance, if it was discovered, I would actually consider making that extra effort to actually physically myself go up to that part of the canyon. Again, now we're talking about 1,300 feet above the river and almost, 2,500 feet down from the rim. So, we're talking some serious relief. Let's put it that way.
There is not enough money. In fact, if you took all the currencies of every country on the planet and offered them to me, it would not be enough to get me to climb or to rappel that distance. Ain't happening. Never, never,
I would
ever.
Actually consider doing it, though, Kevin. I mean, this is so exciting to me. This is the kind of stuff that really... It wets my whistle. It lights that light above my head. This is the kind of thing that I really, really get off on doing. I've always imagined myself as some aspiring Indiana Jones type, and I could think of nothing more thrilling than to be able to identify and access this particular fabled underground city. It would be beyond my wildest dreams to be able to do that.
Well, and the cosmos needs people like you, because it can't count on me for it, I guarantee you.
Well, maybe we'll have Greg Bishop bring us his parasail down, and we can fly you down to a landing spot somewhere on the rim there, or between the rim and the river.
That ain't happening either. No,
oh, man,
that's
it would be so much fun. I mean, to actually find that. I mean, it's beyond our wildest dreams to actually do this.
Let me tell you, it's beyond your wildest dreams to have me climb or parasail in.
Well,
that's never going to happen.
Have you remote view your way down along with the rest of the team members, and you can be with us in spirit. How's that?
Yeah, that might happen.
Or we'll have a live feed on the internet, and you could be manning the
There you go.
On the rim.
There you go. Now, I agree to that. I absolutely agree to stream live that expedition.
Yeah. You could be Cookie, our camp chef.
Yeah, as long as I'm on terra firma.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, the Grand Canyon is quite an amazing place. It's the only place that I could go 200 times and never get bored. Always be excited when I go there. Every time I go there, it's an exciting event for me. I it's the number one natural wonder of the world, consistently voted that way every year. And it's just so magnificent to see it from the South Rim. But when you go on that point where the confluence is, and that canyon is wrapping around you, it is the most beautiful thing I have ever seen. And I have a bunch of photographs on my website from the trip. Go to OurStrangePlanet.com. There's an extensive three-part article. I'm getting ready to publish the ending of it, which we'll talk about here in a minute. But all you have to do is look at some of the photographs there and see the footage that we're going to be playing here in a minute, and you'll get a sense of the majesty and just wondrous scenic beauty that's there.
Well, I want to throw an idea at you. The original discoverer of this back in 1909 is coming down the river. He's looking for paleo mining sites,
mm-hmm.
and just by chance sees a dark stream of stain coming down the side of the cliff and figures maybe that's one of these sites, so he climbs up, right?
At great peril to himself.
Okay. It's that stream of stuff coming down that stain showing where something has been draining down that cliff out of what we're calling an entrance. That's the curious thing. If this is really an entrance, how in the heck would you get up to it? On the other hand, I mean, how did they, 10,000 people, you didn't have 10,000 people climbing the cliff. So how did they get up there? On the other hand...
Well, that's going on the assumption, Kevin, that that's the only entrance. There may be...
No. I want to stick with this one.
Okay.
It's not an entrance. It's an exit. That's where they were dumping stuff out.
Yeah, there you go. That makes sense. The back door, yeah.
It's the back door. And so, if the Smithsonian went in there, and I think they did... It's quite possible they have followed all of the tunnels, mapped it all, and found the front door.
Yes, and that dovetails into the next part of our conversation.
It does indeed, and perhaps that is why you made a discovery of something happening up there. You didn't find this city, but you did find something else very curious. So tell us about that.
Well, yeah, we divided up our expedition into 3 days. We were there for a total of 4 days. The first day we did a scouting trip to the actual confluence, that point that juts out right where the Colorado and Little Colorado come together. And then the second day we brought the rest of the team out to that spot, and on the third day four of us went out further south towards the area going upstream of the Little Colorado where the place of emergence for the Hopi is. And you know, one thing I must stress, this was a really difficult undertaking. We had sustained winds of 40 to 50 miles an hour. It was 95 degrees out. It was like being in the world's largest blow dryer. Sand got in everything. My tent collapsed every day and night. We had to camp 14 miles away at the nearest trees to get some sort of cover and shade. The spider web of roads that goes out there, is it makes no sense. You have to navigate your way out there just based on dead reckoning. There's no maps of the area that are accurate. And that's getting out to the confluence. When we tried to go to the Salt Trail Canyon area, it was even more difficult. And on that last day that the four of us, Gary David, Ron McGair, Clifford Mahudi, and myself, we were zigzagging our way out. It took several hours to just go that 16 miles or so to get out there. I'm very aware of the tourist helicopter flights that fly out of Grand Canyon Airport. And on all 3 days, I was able to spot Maverick helicopters, Grand Canyon Tours, Papillon, and the tour companies that fly very predictable routes with the tourist helicopters. And so it wasn't that big of a deal to see helicopters flying, you know, several thousand feet up, and you could predict exactly where they were going to go, where they were going to turn. When we got out close to the Sepapu area on the Little Colorado River Gorge, we noticed some unusual helicopter activity that was very low to the ground. And when we finally got within 2.5-3 miles of Salt Trail Canyon, we noticed a helicopter flying down into the Little Colorado River Gorge, and underneath, at about 70-foot cable, was slung underneath this Bell Jet Ranger, and there was a load of pipe. A large load slung underneath, and this thing went down into restricted airspace. Now, you're not allowed to fly over Grand Canyon. The reason why the Federal Aeronautics Administration was set up in the first place was because of a collision of a passenger jet and a commuter plane over Grand Canyon, where over 150 people died. And so they have very strict no-flight zone set up throughout the whole area, and the tourist flights have to fly outside of that. Well, these guys were going directly into the Little Colorado River Gorge, and we saw not one, not two, not three, not four. We saw 5 flights go down there. I was able to videotape 2 of these flights, including one section of footage that shows a load slung underneath the helicopter. And one of our goals to get out to that portion of the canyon was for Clifford to do a sacred ceremony, a Zuni ceremony, to bless the area. And when we saw this, I kind of turned and looked at Clifford, and I said, I guess that puts the kibosh on any sort of blessing. And he let out a string of expletives and said, boy, that's an understatement. But yeah, if you queue up the video that I
they're watching it now.
People can get an idea of what we actually were able to document. And this brings into question some pretty interesting elements that subsequent to our expedition we were able to uncover. And it basically boils down to the Navajo have unilaterally decided to attempt to build a $250 million casino at the confluence on the rim, with a 1.5-mile tramway or gondola that goes from the rim down to the confluence to a restaurant and park. And we don't think that this activity that we witnessed, the helicopters and the loads, we don't think that it had anything to do with this proposed project that the Navajo are attempting to undertake. We think that there is something else going on, and the casino may be a cover for some sort of work that's already underway underground by somebody, the government, some, you know, Goldfinger, rich billionaire type. We're not sure.
Okay, why do you think
our
that?
Our hunch is that they've already started developing that underground area.
Why do you think that?
Well, there would be no other reason, because of the moratorium on mining in that area, because the John Kyle water bill was not passed. It was struck down by Congress. There is no other reason for there to be that type of construction flight activity in the area. There's no rhyme or reason for it to be taking place. And one thing that we noticed when we got close enough, one of the returning flights, we actually were able to videotape the staging area where a bunch of trucks were parked and where they were loading these helicopter loads, and then the choppers were taken off and flying down into the gorge. When they saw us, we noticed instantly that they readjusted their flight plan. Instead of flying 500 feet above Salt Trail Canyon and then diving into the canyon, they were diving into Salt Trail Canyon to try to hide from us. Now, the nearest person to us was who knows how many miles away, you know, in terms of Navajo that live out there. This is an extremely remote area. There are no houses. There's no human habitation. There's just a few little farms that are about 10 miles away. Extremely difficult terrain to navigate. There's very, very few roads, and what roads there are peter out. There's no rhyme or reason to any sort of ranch road system out there. So we couldn't figure out any other explanation for the type of activity we were able to document. There's no rhyme or reason for anyone to be flying, you know, these very expensive flights, carrying construction equipment, pipes, and big loads down into a restricted airspace. So there's something fishy going on there, and it's not the humpback chub that supposedly they were reintroducing into the area. That was one of the excuses that we were given by authorities from the national park. They said, well, they're reintroducing the humpback chub. Well, it doesn't take huge loads of pipes and you know, at least five helicopter flights that we personally witnessed to do something like that. So we think that there is some other active program that's already underway in the area.
How far, now people have been that are watching our TV channel, and if you're not watching, if you're not able to, you need to join so you can get that, okay? As a member, that's one of the features, one of the benefits. All right, now this, they've been watching your video of these helicopter flights going right down into the canyon. All right, so what is it? Well, two questions. First of all, how far is this from the area where you think the entrance to the or the exit to that city is?
Well, they were flying right down to the place of emergence, the Sipapu, the 70-foot travertine dome on the eastern bank of the Little Colorado Gorge. That's where the Indians say they go underground before the earth cleanses itself. So they were flying directly down to that spot.
Okay, so that is, I think you told us, about 5 miles from where you think...
As the crow flies, yeah.
As a crow flies, it's about 5 miles to where you think this exit or entrance into that city would be. Okay.
Correct. In other words, it's 2 miles up from the confluence, but going up the Little Colorado. If you go down the Little Colorado, that 2 miles, make a right turn to the east and go 2 miles, 2.5 miles up the Colorado River. That's where Jordan's entrance supposedly is. As the crow flies, it's only about 5 or 6 miles away.
Is it possible that, now we have to take a break, but I'll ask this question. We'll get to it when we come back. Is it possible they are at the entrance and doing something? We'll be back right after this.
City, and you're listening to the Kevin Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and this is Kevin Smith. This evening, my guest is Chris O'Brien. And we're talking about this expedition to attempt to find the entrance to this reported lost ancient city in the Grand Canyon. It's in a cave. It's in a great cavern up 1,300 feet up the side of a cliff. But I made the point earlier that what we're calling an entrance would be for us because that would be how you get in these days. But the report said that the guy that discovered it in 1909 actually discovered it because he saw this stain coming down the cliff, and when he thought it was an ancient mine. So when he climbed up there, he discovered it was actually an ancient city inside the cliff, subterranean, inside the cliff. But I made the point that that stain indicates it's probably an exit, plus you didn't have 10,000 people climbing up the cliff to get in. So this is likely one of the exits, and they're throwing stuff out. They're sweeping stuff out, and it's caused the stain to come down the cliff. So this is an exit. So where's the entrance? Is it possible that these helicopters that we were watching, is it possible they are doing some kind of construction at the entrance? So what do you think, Chris?
I think that that's a pretty likely scenario. If I would have to venture a theory or a guess about it, yeah, I think that perhaps they have located or even established another entrance. You know, who knows? Maybe the prior, you know, civilization that was underground, maybe a rock slide obscured the entrance. Maybe they've re-excavated some sort of entrance or egress point in the Little Colorado, as opposed to the Colorado Grand Canyon. So yeah, that makes sense to me. One thing that I have found interesting is the fact that right above this area, they want to build a $250 million casino and put a tramway down to the actual confluence itself, you know, a mile and a half down. You know, if they do it, it's going to be quite a tourist destination.
How far is that from where these helicopters were going in?
Less than 2 miles.
Okay, so they were not going in right at where that tramway would be ending.
No, they actually was about 2.5 to 3 miles away from where that tramway would end. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So they were further upstream to the south, going up river up the Little Colorado.
Okay.
And one of the things that I find as a possibility is maybe they're going to build a casino above the underground city, and if you have a special pass or some sort of permission, you can take the secret elevator like at Hot Springs, Arkansas, and go down into the underground facility, which is for the well-heeled mucky mucks. Maybe they've already mapped out the entire complex and are putting in luxury suites in there. You know, with all this millennialist sort of end of the world, sort of end of Mayan calendar hoopla that's going on, that wouldn't surprise me that, you know, the casino above could be a cover for some sort of access to an underground continuation of government facility. We do know the government has the ability to map several miles into the Earth's crust, and I think the system, the first parts of the system went operational in 1998, and so they have ground-penetrating radar technology that's mapped the Giza Plateau, the Yucatan Peninsula. The third place that they mapped was the Rocky Mountains and parts of the northern New Mexico area where this underground cavern system we talked about at the top of the show is allegedly located. So there's a lot of different possible scenarios that could be going on here, but the one that makes the most sense to me, which is what Clifford Mahudi was the first one to think along these lines, is that the casino is actually a cover for development of this underground facility for the 1% of us out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it could be that. Can you imagine anything that may be in this ancient subterranean structure other than a place for survival in the event of all of the catastrophes that are supposed to be coming, according to some prophecies or some interpretations of prophecies?
Right.
Can you think of anything that might be in there that would be of interest to the government? And I think there is. And let me tell you why I think there is.
That's a good question.
Here's why I think there is. Because back in 1909, they weren't thinking end of the world Mayan prophecy. and they covered it up.
Yeah, who knows when they actually first went in there, if they even did, and what they've done subsequent to that mapping of the underground facility in there, and whether they've maybe turned it into some sort of facility of some kind. A lot of your work is done for you. I mean, we're talking about some pretty hard limestone. That whole uplift there is limestone, and then further down is sandstone. So it does have the proper geology to have a very viable underground facility there. And, why not, instead of spending billions of dollars drilling out your own new facility, why not just expand one that's already there?
I can see that for now. I mean, I can see that in these times. But what's interesting to me is that it's scant evidence, true, but it is evidence. But the evidence is that the Smithsonian went in. There was no real secrecy about it at first because it was all over that newspaper. But as soon as the Smithsonian goes in, all of a sudden it becomes secret. And there's no further reports. They did build a rail spur because that rail spur has been identified from satellite photographs where the rail spur was. So that story about building the rail spur to carry the stuff out, that's true. But
well,
back then in 1909,
if you look at the photographs on my website, the article that I've, the three-part article that I have, there is an aerial view of a very interesting rectangular configuration of what appear to be just roads, two-tracked ranch roads, basically, but they're in perfectly straight lines, unlike all the roads that spiderweb their way out there. And if you look very carefully, you can notice that it looks like ancient irrigation systems are running parallel to these roads. And it would stand to reason that if you had 10, 15, 20,000 people living underground, you're going to have to feed them. So what a perfect place to have some sort of agricultural project above the facility, and we think that we've identified what looked to be ancient irrigation canals and catchwater basins and that sort of thing. We also discovered some quasi megalithic sites on our way out there, a 70 foot by 60 foot ring of limestone with big sanding stones, some of them over two tons in weight, that do not conform to anything that we know of that the Pueblo Indians have built. So, mm-hmm. Again, I produced a 30-minute documentary covering our trip, which I'm just waiting for the narration to be completed, and I will be posting that. And I'll obviously, Kevin, I'll let you and your listeners know about that when it's posted.
Okay.
But, we do have some pretty interesting archaeological evidence above, the alleged city, which would indicate that there's some pretty interesting things have gone on out there that are not part of the conventional historic record.
So in other words, what you have found appears to be ancient infrastructure for the support of a city the size we're talking about, subterranean.
Well, on the surface, that's what it would appear, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we
but
can't
you see what I'm saying, that, though, about the cover-up in 1909? They weren't thinking end of the world, Mayan catastrophe stuff. And yet, suddenly, it became quiet. So what did they find in there that made the Smithsonian say, we got to keep this quiet?
Well, that's a good question, of course, that goes into the realm of speculation. But according to Jordan's descriptions of the artifacts, I mean, there was some valuable stuff in there. And obviously, if this information came to light, it would totally overturn conventional theories on human, habitation of the Americas. So, You know, it's like that scene at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark when they're wheeling the Ark in that huge, you know, Warehouse 13, you know, where they're wheeling this big artifact in a crate into a huge holding facility filled with boxes of who knows what. Maybe some of those boxes are the 109 truckloads of artifacts allegedly pulled out of that cavern.
Do you think they would do it? I mean, look, let's say they find a 12-foot-tall golden statue of a Buddha. You think they would hide that?
Well, we haven't seen it, so, you know, I mean, it stands to reason that if this story is true, and that's a big if, we don't have any corroborating evidence to suggest that the story is true. There are some rumors of the Smithsonian dumping artifacts off of Baltimore Harbor in the early 50s. I did uncover a claim by a journalist who was looking into the Underground City story and approached the Smithsonian, was able to compromise somebody within the organization and was going to do an expose, and according to this particular rumor, instead of fessing up that they had these artifacts, they elected to load a barge in Baltimore Harbor, take it a number of miles out into the Atlantic and dump it. I mean, the hubris, you know, if that's true, I mean, it really does, it makes you wonder why academia and conventional archaeology would push for something like that. I would think that they want to get the story straight about the migration and habitation of North and South America. I would think that they would want that to set the record straight on that. But you never know. I mean, a lot of these guys have made their careers on towing the academic line, so it wouldn't surprise me if they would cut their nose off to spite their face, so to speak.
Well, you know, my theory, and I've stated this on the air several times, is that we live on the Planet of the Apes. And if you remember, the Planet of the Apes had a forbidden zone.
Right.
And the great apes enforced the forbidden zone. They're the ones who said it's forbidden, and they enforced it.
Right.
And enforcing it was a general. Enforcing it was the government leader, and enforcing it was the religious leader. They did not want the other apes to ever go into this forbidden zone. When we come back, I'll tell the audience why, and why I say I think we're in the Planet of the Apes. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are on Final Approach, ladies and gentlemen. We only have a few minutes left. My guest this evening is Chris O'Brien, and we are talking about this very mysterious report of a lost ancient city in the Grand Canyon, and the mystery grows deeper because of the helicopter activity that our members are watching right now. All right, here's why they didn't want on Planet of the Apes. Here is why the great apes did not want the other apes ever to go into the forbidden zone. Because their society was built on fiction. Their society had a story of their origins that was fiction. And their society, there were humans living, but the humans were mute. They didn't talk. And there was a fiction among the apes that they were dumb animals. And in the Forbidden Zone was absolute proof that the humans at one time were intelligent, high-technology beings way before the apes were intelligent beings. and they didn't want that to crack their society. So they threw up a zone around the proof that humans were intelligent, and long before the apes were, preceding the apes, and they called it the Forbidden Zone. We live on the planet of the apes, and the great apes know that we are not the first high-tech civilization on this planet, and they know that we're not even the highest tech civilization that has lived on this planet. This planet is almost it's 4.5 billion years old. And they expect us to believe their version of history, which carries us back to the very oldest civilization that we know anything about. Now, we know about hunters and gatherers and knuckle draggers, but the oldest civilization carries us back, 12,500 B.C., is that right? At Göbekli Tepe?
10,500 B.C. in North America, but...
No, I'm talking about civilization with buildings and architecture.
Göbekli Tepe in Anatolia and Turkey would be your first...
Yeah.
Evidence.
Okay, so what is 12,500 B.C.? So we're talking about, 14, 15,000 years ago. What's that against 4.5 billion years?
Well, I've always been a champion of looking at indigenous people's myths and legends for clues about the distant past, and at the top of the show I mentioned the Hopi and Zuni legends of the ant people being the custodians of the underground city and caring for the natives when they were led underground to survive earth changes. So the obvious knee-jerk assumption, it's impossible not to take the description of ant people, extremely thin, large-headed beings that live underground. Obviously the knee-jerk image that comes to mind is your Whitley Strieber, cover of Communion, your
sure.
rank-and-file gray alien would be, the type of form that may be the basis for a description of a race of beings that live underground that are known today to the Indians here as ant people. Now, Kevin, you know me well enough to know that I'm not an adherent, to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. I wouldn't say that these ant people are extraterrestrials. That wouldn't be my first assumption. But perhaps we do have some sort of crypto-terrestrial or ultra-terrestrial race that is subterranean that may be responsible for if not all of these underground cavern systems that have been reported over the years. So, we need to be open-minded about this and not factor anything in or out, obviously. And I state this as just a what-if conjecture. But perhaps the government, let's say the government did go in there and discover, an elaborate underground complex that had evidence of some sort of non-human intelligence. The last thing they'd want to do is announce this and shatter all preconceived religious, societal, and historical, views and beliefs. By
in other words, they would not want to shatter the fiction.
Your analogy of the Planet of the Apes, I think, is a good one.
Yeah, they wouldn't want to shatter the fiction that they have.
Exactly.
Governments, maybe not each individual government, but governments have enforced the fiction at the point of a sword. And at the end of the barrel of a gun for centuries. And, of course, knowing the truth shows them to be criminal.
Yeah. Well, history is written by the victors. That's one axiom I think we can all agree on.
Yeah. But shattering the fiction shows them to be criminal, and not only that, criminally stupid.
Yeah, well, when it comes to your tax dollars and my tax dollars, all bets are off in terms of, level of intelligence and agendas, I think, on this level could be highly questionable.
Yeah. Now, before anybody says, well, you hate your government, I don't hate my government. I mean, I like being an American. I love it. And,
yeah, me too.
I want my government to be open, honest, and truthful. And the only way that can happen is for us to talk about things when we think they're not being. And I don't think they're being open, honest, and truthful. And I don't think academia worldwide is when it comes to the real history of this planet. I think they are the great apes, and they know, but they are keeping the rest of us from knowing because it's how they control us.
If I had to make a guess, I'd say you're absolutely right on the button with that one.
All right. When's your next expedition? We have to do this pretty quick because we're just about out of time. When's your next expedition?
We're going to be planning on an expedition sometime early in 2013, if the world's still here. Who knows? Maybe the world's going to end here in a couple of months, and I might be jetting 3 hours north of me here and seeing if I can get hitch a ride to be taken underground and cared for by the ant people. I'm not sure if I have the right credentials and the right pass, but who knows? I could get a text message next week saying, "Hey, be at the confluence on such and such a date. You've been elected to be saved."
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you something. 2013 is coming. It's the next page after December 31st, 2012.
About 6 months into the year, we're going to have all hell break loose after everybody's breathed a big sigh of relief.
Well, catastrophes are going to happen. They've happened every year I've been alive, and that's a bunch of them. I was born right after dirt was created.
Every 4 years when there's an election on the federal level for a president, we have a catastrophe happen. So.
Well, yeah. But, no, seriously, natural disasters and catastrophes have happened every year of my life, and they will happen. They happened every year of all lives previous to me. They're going to continue, and some of them are going to be horrendous. But 2013 is coming, and the human race will still be alive.
We'll still be here. I totally agree with that, and I'm going to be down. Filming. I'll be the only person allowed to film it in Shayla, where the long count calendar was devised.
I wish we had more time, but we don't, and I do want to hear about that next time you're on the show. Stay on the line with me for a moment, Chris, as we bring this one in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, that's Chris O'Brien, and I hope some information this evening that you had not heard before. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.